now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. And I had a number of discussions this past week on just what does it mean to reclaim our authenticity. And that's pretty much what it is in a nutshell. It's reclaiming that which has always been in us. We come into this world with gifts and graces and skills and strengths and personalities and such. And for one reason or another, we never find the very best of ourselves. We're like on this constant search. And so it's just something that a lot of people either never think of, or if they just like, this is all you, all I'm ever going to amount to what you see is what you get kind of thing. But a lot of times, because when people experience pain, they might just stuff those feelings down along with their gifts and their strengths and graces and so forth, and just allow those experiences, those circumstances to dictate their identity when that is not the case at all. And so that's what I mean about going back in and healing from those emotional, psychological, perhaps physical, even spiritual wounds, and reclaiming those very parts of ourselves which bring out the very best of us in and through relationships. Anyway, very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. Welcome to autumn. Here we are, finally, over here on the East Coast. We're getting some decent weather, cooler temperatures, and hopefully wherever you are listening that you have good weather today as well. I am Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you want to leave me your comments about today's show, please visit www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show, please call in. That number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls in the second half of the show's hour. And in case you had missed any or part of these shows and you'd like to go back into the archives, these shows are podcasted. And like I said, you can go back in and listen at any time. You can just access those through the website as well. Okay. Well, as I said, I'll be taking your calls in a little bit because I'd really want to hear from you on today's subject. When silence is deafening. When silence is deafening, came up with this title thinking, you know, is this being the last broadcast on the subject of intergenerational trauma for the month of September? And if there's one thing that intergenerational trauma really, how it's characterized, it's putting people into silence. And I know that you know, not too many people are fond of silence. However, there are people who thrive in silence, and they say, this is exactly where I can find my voice. I can find my relationship with God and so forth. But on the other hand, there are people who look at silence and say, you know, this is where I truly, truly suffer. In fact, there are times that I'm made to suffer in silence. So, as I said, throughout the month of September, we've been talking about intergenerational trauma. It's this phenomena that occurs when one generation has faced horrific pain and suffering, but because of not being able to be healed from such woundedness, they pass along that trauma to succeeding generations, either through genetics or learned behavior. And after a while, as you line up a number of generations, you begin to see the pattern of just how devastating those experiences are to not only those who have experienced it firsthand, but also future generations. Well, I'm sure at one point you've heard the expression, silence is golden. But have you ever stopped to consider exactly what that means? Well, basically, if you just want a textbook definition, it's the expression of you have to keep your mouth shut and consider that to be a great virtue. Or, you know, don't tell anybody about this because, you know, silence is golden. And interesting, did a little background on this research on this particular phrase. And yes, there is a very famous song out, you know, silence is golden. But I went back to the original source. It was a poem that was written in 1848. Actually, it's part of a proverb, I should say. And it goes like this. Speech is silver and silence is golden. Speech is silver, silence is golden. Okay, but pretty much the standard definition is just to, you know, to be quiet or to keep your mouth shut is of great virtue. Well, at first, when we consider, you know, being silent or the fact that silence is golden, according to some people, it appears that this sounds like it's very good advice, you know, but it's not a universal truth because it's not always advantageous to remain silent or to be silent, especially when one's been forced into silence or told not to tell or threatened to keep quiet. And this is one of the aspects victims are often told by their abusers or their oppressors, that if they talk, there will be consequences. And as a result, I mean, many people are made to believe that there is no alternative to their suffering. So I just have to suffer in silence, and I just have to bear the psychological, emotional, physical, and spiritual scars. So when you consider just how many people suffer in silence, I had a great discussion earlier this week about, you know, where people suffer in silence at work. We got on the subject of mental health and how mental health is still stigmatized and how many people have to hide their illness or hide the fact that they might be experiencing anxiety or depression, but they don't want anybody to know. So they suffer in silence in that kind of atmosphere. And really, just over time, as people do that, they find that you know, they are lacking in additional support or resources that could be made available to them. And it often builds camaraderie among colleagues who are working, let's say, an office together or, you know, just part of a team, work team, and so forth. But a lot of people fear that if they disclose, then they will be taken advantage of. They will be ridiculed. They'll be shamed. They'll be intimidated or something of that. But to suffer in silence, I know, is just oftentimes a common phrase, but it's more than just a cultural expression. But many people who do suffer from a mental health illness or trauma, and if they suffer those things in silence, perhaps because they don't know how to put in the words, the depth of their pain and suffering or relentless misery. Well, my encounters really with understanding silence in and of itself has expanded over the years when I first started to research intergenerational trauma. And one of the questions that I just kept asking myself is, how do you capture the very essence of how much suffering a person or persons experienced? And is there a word in our language, the language of humanity, that captures it all? Actually, there is such a word, I found. And there is a word in the Korean language referred to as Han, H-A-N. And this word captures feelings of sorrow and oppression, unavenged injustice, isolation, and it's truly hard to explain, even though we have a word for it, because there isn't really an English equivalent to this understanding. But Han also expresses a continuous and relentless anguish of a whole people, especially the people who are powerless or vulnerable in society. But let's say, for example, another group of people or another power comes in and attempts to erase everything, such as like one's language, one's culture, one's identity. And this often becomes just such an unfathomable wound, a rupture of the soul, so to speak, that is caused by abuse or exploitation or injustice or violence. And when that kind of an aching soul is wounded over and over again by external violence, then the victim themselves suffer just this deep, deep, deep ache. And the wound produced by such repeated abuse and injustice is often found in the depths of the soul. But how do you bring that out to give it voice? Because our society tends to victimize victims. One of my favorite authors, you've probably heard me speak of her in these earlier shows, is Dorothy Solé. And her great quote is, pain that cannot be given a voice is pain that cannot be healed. Pain that cannot be given a voice is pain that cannot be healed. And that's a very true statement. That's a great observation on her part. And I've seen this in action many, many times as well. That when people cannot give voice to their pain, cannot give voice to their suffering, it just something about that being made to be silent just really keeps a person from being healed. But it does take courage to talk to others about your suffering, whether it be anxiety, depression, or whatever, because they may, you know, see you in a different light. They may see, you know, and you in your struggles and have empathy for you. And like I said, it does take a lot of motivation and tolerance to, you know, pull through a period of suffering, you know, so to speak, or hardship. But I, you know, personally, my observation is I just do not see that suffering in silence is sustainable, because of just the emotional toll that it takes on a person, and just being able, you know, or being forced to hide one's feelings or their voice, or even just let it be known that something had happened to them. But you and I both know that when the truth does come out, and a person who has been victimized or suffering has finally found their voice and they are able to tell others, then just a tremendous, tremendous healing takes place, as well as giving others the permission to share their stories as well. Well, for the most part, I've noticed during this pandemic is that people in general do not like silence. It's just something that we have a hard time, you know, just getting used to, because perhaps we fill our days with, you know, noise and so forth, the hustle and bustle of traffic, or even background noise like the TV or the radio while we have it on at work or at home. You know, it's some things that distract us from everyday tasks. And yet, how often do we take advantage of silence? You know, how often do we allow ourselves time to be in silence? Well, not too many times, I imagine. Like I said, it's something I think we all struggle with. And yet, how many times do we interpret silence as a bad thing, or let's say a negative thing, you know, such as we have to fill time with some other noise? We just can't make or sit quietly. And what about, I'm sure you've all experienced this, but what about when a person is mad at you and you get the proverbial silent treatment? Okay, you can just tell in an instant that, okay, something's wrong, what's the matter? Okay, and you get to talk it out. But again, it's very difficult to hold in that amount of pain without taking an emotional or psychological, physical, even spiritual toll on a person. Well, interestingly enough, with this notion of silence, another aspect of intergenerational trauma that seems to go hand in hand with reinforcing suffering in silence is the public apology. Yeah. You heard me correct. Yeah, the public apology. Now, you would think that this would not be the case, but that an apology encourages others to break their silence and it will end their suffering. Well, you and I both know, if you've listened to many public apologies, sometimes they come away seeming genuine, and other times a person comes away and they sound scripted. Okay, and it just doesn't have that air of sincerity in it. Well, within recent decades, there's been a steady stream of public apologies made on behalf of, let's say, government or ecclesiastical leaders for the inhumane treatment or sexual abuses or prejudiced behavior or outright slaughter of people from many cultural backgrounds. And public acknowledgement of such behavior comes often as a result of uncovering, you know, crimes against humanity or investigative reporting and or the work of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, to name a few. And albeit a step in the right direction, some of these apologies for the historical atrocities often include an air of, I would like to say, a dismissive justification of, well, that's the way the world was back then, kind of explanation for the mistreatment of people for the greater good of a nation, or to say the greater good of a cause, or the greater good for the world. And in a sense, we have contemporary leaders who often offer an apology for the past without accepting responsibility for doing anything wrong, let alone acknowledging being part of a socioeconomic, political, educational, and or religious systems that still perpetuate oppressive schemes. And whether it was in the name of the advancement of science or manifest destiny or believed to be a divine right, violence in one form or another has always been justified against a weaker, undereducated, undercivilized, and or underdeveloped people. And ironically, the rationale for force always seems to come from the perspective of people who, let's say, could use their military might or political power or religious zeal and or just an outright lust to hang on to their piece of power and control for as long as possible. This is just one thing that history just is, it's just glaringly obvious. And we often see this coming down through the generation, from one generation to another, this phenomena, this intergenerational trauma, and how people have been treated and continued to be treated. And repeatedly, you have these emotional, physical, psychological, and spiritual abuses. They certainly incriminate those who have been exploited who have exploited and manipulated their power for either this worldwide colonization and or genocide in countries such as, let's say, America, Canada, the Congo, Germany, Russia, Rwanda, Ireland, Australia, and many other places. In fact, anywhere else, you know, where we have violence and genocide that has occurred. Well, on one hand, public apologies do acknowledge the cruel and inhumane acts done to vulnerable populations. Okay? And such apologies do raise a sense of community awareness and empathy regarding the devastation and the intergenerational traumatic effects of the suffering of others. And as words of empathy are offered, many victims and survivors, they feel vindicated, and they're grateful for the public voices raised on behalf of those who have yet to find their healing voice. And yet, also, on the other hand, some public apologies are often, like as I said earlier, looked at as very superficial and often rejected by, let's say, more contemporary populations whose ancestors have not only been victimized in such horrors, but the succeeding generations continue to feel that accountability and justice has never, ever really been served. Therefore, for many, these apologies and explanations and offer of, let's say, financial compensation just really only add insult to the intergenerational wounds in people who continue to feel that sting of a hand that has just been slapped across their face. I did come across an article written by McEvers. I think it was dated around 2015. And he recalls a speech that was made in the summer. I think it was also July of 2015 that year, that Pope Francis apologized to Bolivia's indigenous leaders for the church's crimes and sins against native people. He says, "I would also say, and here I wish to be quite clear, as was St. John Paul II, I humbly ask your forgiveness, not only for the offenses of the church herself, but also for crimes committed against the native peoples during the so-called conquest of America." Well, although his apology was initially warmly received, say, by many California Native American Indian populations, there were many among these populations who felt betrayed by Pope Francis. Because within 2 months of this apology, if you recall, seeing this in the news, you know, years back in 2015, this is when Pope Francis canonized Father Junipero Serra in Washington, D.C. And despite the fact that Father Serra had established 9 of the 21 missions along the California coast back in the 1700s, Father Serra also came under a lot of criticism over his physical mistreatment and suppression of Native people. And whereas once there were hundreds of thousands of Californian Native American Indians and they had flourished, within 100 years after Father Serra's arrival, the indigenous population had been decimated to around 16,000. And like I said, it was just quite a controversy with the canonization of Father Serra, because there is still tremendous, tremendous pain and suffering on behalf of the Native American Indians in California. Well, perhaps another reason why public apologies often fall short in their effectiveness to bring healing is because of the confusing motivation behind the apology. You know, think of it this way. Are public apologies meant to excuse behavior or dismiss accountability? Are public apologies meant to excuse behavior or dismiss accountability? Our public apology is able to capture the historical perspective that justifies behavior based on what was considered legal at the time, or do public apologies simply point out the ethical and moral injustices? And I mean, these are very important questions to ask because, again, when a public apology is offered, one wants to believe that true change will follow, that true transformation will occur, and that among people who have suffered tremendously, that the healing can continue and move one step closer to being complete for them. Well, from the benefit of hindsight, we might interpret that certain actions of, let's say, the intergenerational trauma or the crimes against humanity were unethical or immoral in their day, but nonetheless, they were permitted because people acted according to the law of the land, so to speak. And in other words, are then now public apologies considered appropriate based on actions that were considered legal according to either our contemporary laws or was it considered legal according to the laws of that day? For example, in October 2014, the Tuam Herald Viewpoint from Tuam, Ireland, did this article. Here's the title: "The Harsh Facts of Life in 1946 Put Modern Controversies in a Different Perspective." That's a mouthful right there. The Harsh Facts of Life in 1946 put modern controversies in a different perspective. And the author, he had communicated to the readers that, we simply cannot judge the actions of the past by today's standard. And any assessment of those years has to take into account, the grinding poverty and lack of resources at this time. And this article was in response to the controversy surrounding the discovery of 796 infants and children buried in an unmarked mass grave in the septic tanks behind St. Mary's Mother and Baby Home in Tuam County, Galway, Ireland. And in response to that article, many people still believe that regardless of the economic times, mother baby homes like that in Tuam or others were not as affected by poverty or lacked resources as one thought. In fact, most of the domesticated work, such as cooking or tending the vegetable gardens and child rearing, were performed by the young mothers who stayed in the home up to a year after giving birth. But still, regardless of whether we judge the past according to the present or vice versa, how do these issues of accountability need to be addressed? I mean, if public apologies for past atrocities are simply about matters of justice, then why were injustices not addressed at the time in history when they were committed? I mean, why now? I mean, after all, many of these atrocities have been committed many decades and centuries ago with people who took part in such crimes against humanity are either now deceased or elderly or infirmed. And perhaps the answers lie in the fact that society, you know, whether or not society wants to admit it, perhaps it had a bigger role to play in reinforcing the wishes of a leader or a group or political power or something. And perhaps then the systems in place had more to gain than what was considered lost. Well, I have to say, I did visit Ireland. And I walked on the grounds where these mother children homes are or were. And I talked to townspeople. I talked to survivors of those who were, made to stay at these places. And I interviewed particular survivors of the Magdalene laundries, and many women explained to me that how such a system kept the, as they were often described, the mad, the sad, and the bad girls out of sight and in some secret place, and how they often felt betrayed by families when they were sent to these laundries, often carrying the shame of their promiscuous behavior with them. And adding insult to injury, they were also made to wear uniforms and work long hours of heavy physical labor. And if one of the girls managed to escape, or one of the women managed to escape, townsfolk easily identified them by their uniforms and promptly returned them to one of these laundries. So as I was sitting there talking to these women, interviewing them, and just astonished at the stories that they are telling me, I just spoke up and I asked, where were the men when all this was going on? I mean, interesting, none of the men were ever punished or shamed like this. In fact, men are hardly ever mentioned at all in the stories of the women. Several women shared with me then that sometimes it didn't matter whether or not you had a boyfriend. Your shame, so to speak, was the result of emotional or physical and or sexual abuse, let's say, by your brother or father or an uncle or a priest. And yet, in our search for truth and justice, are we content just to single out one person as a scapegoat for such atrocities? Or perhaps are we afraid to admit that such crimes had enough community support and oxygen, so to speak, to be fueled for centuries? Were these atrocities just merely a breakdown in the system, or was the system itself faulty to begin with? And furthermore, you know, we living in the 21st century here, do we have the resolve to hold our contemporary systems accountable for perpetuating crimes against humanity, regardless of the way things have done or have been done in the past? Okay. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, please do so. That number is 888-627-6008, 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to say something quick about next week's show. Next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. It is entitled The Blessing of the Liminal Space. And if you're not familiar with that term, a liminal space is the time between the what was and the next. It's a place of transitioning. It's a waiting. It's a not knowing. It's, a, as many people would say, a very uncomfortable place to be in. But I like to reframe that for not only myself, but family members and clients, and just say, perhaps this is the best place we could be in because we know something is coming. We know that, let's say, perhaps a transformation is ongoing, and just what is that going to look like? That could also be very exciting, and we always have to kind of like check ourselves with, you know, not that we want to be Debbie Downers, but we can get really pessimistic, as to say, just because we go through a transition, does that mean there's something wrong? And it's like, you know, just the opposite. You know, something very nice is going on, something that we don't see yet, but, you know, perhaps it's something that's, let's say, an answer to prayer or an answer to somebody else's prayer or something. But basically, this liminal space, you know, takes this concept of a threshold, and it applies many times to like our transitions, or maybe even a sense of ambiguity, or even waiting. And if we want to go down the road in spiritual terms, it often becomes a time of growth or a learning or a spiritual transformation if the person experiences it, embraces that opportunity. So there's a little bit of responsibility there for us as well. It's not like we're just being carried along by the flow of a river, but it is a very, very powerful time in the lives of many, many people. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about people who suffer in silence, as well as looking at some historical atrocities that have perpetuated that silence, just because they've perpetuated the trauma down through the generations, and the systems that are in place just make it very, very difficult for people not only to find their voice, but also for people to heal. And so people often feel as though they're just made to continue in that silence. Well, Returning back to the historical context of an intergenerational trauma, a common phrase that often drives a lot of uncovering, shall we say, of historical atrocities is, what did they know and when did they know it? I mean, we hear that on the news. You know, what did they know and when did they know it? And regardless of the historical context in which such horrors have occurred, it appears that surrounding communities were also aware of these atrocities and passively, perhaps, gave their consent by their own silent indifference. And clearly, you know, no one or ever, you know, or group ever involved in crimes against humanity has ever acted alone. That's just something that, you know, the more we know about history and the more these crimes have been uncovered to kind of get to the bottom of it, so to speak, the more and more we often see just a tremendous either a covering up from, you know, one system to another, or just how systems were so intertwined or colluded and very complicit in what was going on back then. But if you've ever seen the 2015 movie Spotlight, it has this flavor, too, of those who suffer in silence, and as well as the collusion to keep the secrecy of such crimes. And it's a true story of the Boston Globe's uncovering of the child molestation scandal and the cover-up with the local Catholic archdiocese. And in one scene, the investigator, Mitchell, I think it's Garabedian, acknowledges the real issue behind the scandal. You know, and he's noted for this quote. He says, "This city, these people, making the rest of us feel like we don't belong, but they're no better than us. Look how they treat their children. Mark my words, Mr. Resendez, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to abuse one." Because when it was all said and done, there were about 249 priests who were publicly accused of sexual abuse within the Boston Archdiocese. And then later, over 600 stories were published about that scandal. And in 2002, Cardinal Law, that's when he had resigned from the Boston Archdiocese. And he was just one of the highest ranking Roman Catholic officials there is, and one of the highest ranking Roman Catholic churches. He resigned to the Basilica di Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome. Okay, very, very prestigious. But you know, family and government, and religious, financial, education, and socioeconomic systems often, if you want a good image for this, it's how they often form a spider web of deceitfulness. And just like a spider, the corruption of systems know all too well which the threads of the web would allow them to move freely and which of these threads would ensnare a population's prey. I mean, it's just something, if you want to do a quick, fascinating study, just study spiders and their webs. It's not entirely sticky, but there are some threads that doesn't catch the spider, but allows the spider to move up and down the web. But for the unsuspecting fly, the fly will be caught. Well, as I interviewed, you know, these women who had survived the experiences of neglect and abuse and pain at, let's say, the mother-child homes and the Magdalene laundries, and I listened to their stories and their eyewitnesses' account, and another question that was raised in me was that I couldn't help wondering what effects that these experiences had on a person's soul, let alone the soul of the community. And I just, you know, just sat there and I just kept asking myself, when does reconciliation begin for these women? When does reconciliation begin for anyone? When were they allowed to leave these homes and laundries? And were the women welcomed back then into their families? And were they welcomed back within their communities who knew exactly where they had been? Or is it a case of the Scarlet Letter, You know, Hester Prynne was just made to wear that scarlet A for adultery because, well, you know, everybody knew what had happened to her, and therefore she was the one alone that bore the pain and the shame and the humiliation of having her, shall we say, sins paraded around for everybody. But how does a person get out from under that? How do they not allow what they have done or not, or where they have been or not, to be that emotional anchor for them, that they just drop anchor and they say, that's it, my life is over? You know, everybody knows, and it is, you don't, might as just put this stigma around my neck, and it's just something I have to bear. And this also plays into keeping people in silence and suffering in silence, because if people know and word gets out, well, that's just more pain to bear. So how do you do this? You know, how does a person get out from under where they have been, you know, and what they have done? Perhaps they've done something very unlawful and they've paid their debts to society. But what is it like for them to come back to their communities, or are they able to come back to their communities? Is there still a fear in the community, or the court of public opinion, shall we say? Just how deep do those roots go down in a person, thinking that, you know, I no longer have a friend, you know, at home. I no longer have a friend in my community. I have to go live somewhere else, and hopefully nobody recognizes me, or they check up on my past, and then the story's out all over again. It seems as though people are forever branded by, you know, what they have done. Well, interestingly enough, returning to Ireland here, there was a report of the commission to inquire into child abuse. It was also like simply known as the Ryan Report back in 2009. And really, I mean, nobody could have ever anticipated the public response to the research findings of widespread physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of society's most vulnerable: infants, girls, boys, and women in the Irish residential institutions. And the executive team, they provided a summary in their 2,600-page report, and here are just a few. They said there was extreme physical and emotional abuse, as well as physical and emotional neglect. This was a prominent feature of these institutions. Sexual abuse occurred in the institutions, and this was particularly as so in boys' institutions. And schools were run in a harsh and regimented manner that served to impose unreasonable and oppressive discipline on children and staff alike. Children frequently went hungry. At its best, the food was inadequate and it was inedible and badly prepared by many in the school. And many witnesses testified to having been constantly fearful, even terrified, that these institutions impacted on them in their lives, you know, almost every day of their life in the institution. And when children who ran away were caught, they were severely beaten, at times publicly, or let's say they had their head shaved, or they were humiliated in other ways. Well, on that one hand, many people breathed a sigh of relief that finally the stories of thousands of women and men who had been abused in various ways over the past 60 years were becoming known. And yet, ironically, others were outraged also it exposed the decades of collusion that existed between the Irish government and Catholic organizations who ran such institutions. Now, previously, the government officials had emphatically stated that these institutions were privately owned and operated by vowed religious people, and therefore they denied any involvement in the mistreatment of adults and children and even babies. However, as far back as the 1940s, the Ryan Report also highlighted how government inspectors of the Magdalene laundries did nothing to intervene when they confirmed suspicious reports of broken bones or malnourishment or neglect as a result of, you know, say, the random physical beatings or the sexual assault and the emotional humiliation of girls who were forced to live there. But still, many people were hopeful. They believed that justice for the victims and survivors would now finally be served as the government and ecclesiastical leaders called for accountability and prosecution for anyone responsible for such abuses. However, the survivors' hopes were quickly dashed when it was communicated to them that the findings would not be used for criminal prosecutions, mainly due to the successful litigation by individuals to keep their identities unnamed in the report. In fact, no real names, whether of victims or perpetrators, appear in the final document. And yet, it was not until 4 years later that the government publicly admitted its role in the mistreatment of thousands of women and girls in the notorious Magdalene laundry system. But in doing so, it stopped short of issuing a formal apology. And despite the acknowledgement from Senator Martin McAleese stating that there was significant state involvement in how the laundries were run, the Irish Premier, Edna Kenny's regret about the stigma hanging over women and Cardinal Brady's being profoundly sorry and deeply ashamed that children suffered in such awful ways in these institutions, many survivors felt betrayed by their leaders, and it pushed them back into further silence. Just when they thought they were able to, shall we say, find their voices or to have their voices acknowledged and their pain acknowledged and brought out into the open and to create, you know, have an opportunity to create a powerful transformation, a healing opportunity in not just individuals, but also families and communities and institutions and the very systems. But it just seemed to clamp down harder on really not getting to the bottom of, you know, what was really going on there, because nobody really wanted to, take responsibility. In fact, that was something that I was told when I was in Ireland talking to these women. It just felt like when it came to taking responsibility, it's like it was like a three-card Monty, where you try to find the ball under the cards, you know, or, you know, you try to find, the dollar bill or something, whatever. You've seen the game where you just have three cards and you just get shuffled really quickly, and then you have to point to the one in which you think something is under, an object is under that. And if you pick the right one, you win some money. If not, well, you lose money. Okay, but that's how they described it, as just a one big shuffle game of just, we don't know. I don't know. I don't see it. I can't blame us because that wasn't us. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And in the whole process, more and more survivors, more and more who were related to, by their DNA to those who lived in these laundries and you know, who were the mothers and perhaps grandmothers or aunts or sisters, they are just driven deeper and deeper into silence. In fact, I think the survivors didn't think that such, public apologies, when they heard them, ever touched the depth of, let's say, their physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual trauma that still plagued them. And when the Ryan Report also suggested building a permanent memorial and providing counseling and education services and to improving current child protection services, again, many people I interviewed interpreted these reparations as suspect. Just any kind of trust between them, communities, and the government was pretty much shot at that point. In fact, survivors who were initially, you know, filled with elation over the public apology from, say, I think it was Taoiseach Edna Kenny, survivors felt that because he didn't follow through with the recommendations, you know, they felt that his apology was nothing more than drama. And again, this is what really keeps people in silence. This is what keeps people wondering and suffering, you know, like, how much longer do I have to carry this? How much longer do I have to be in silence? How much longer until I can find my voice and raise my voice and somebody will understand, somebody will reach out, somebody will help me heal? And over time, you know, government and church officials believe that public confidences would be restored and things that would definitely get better. And this is always what comes across in public apologies. But it was interesting, again, you know, not to pick on Ireland today, but, you know, just since we're on the subject, you know, thinking that, okay, they were let down or the Ryan report wasn't as strong as they wanted it to be and so forth, and nobody would be prosecuted and that. Still, they believed that things would get better. However, I don't know if you ever had seen this, but only like 5 years ago, back in 2015, there was an article entitled "Thousands of Children in Irish Care Homes at Center of Baby Graves Scandal Were Used in Secret Vaccine Trials in the 1930s. Do you want me to say that again? Okay. Thousands of children in Irish care homes at the center of baby grave scandal were used in secret vaccine trials in the late 30s. And this is going back to the mother-child home in Tuam, T-U-A-M. And in this particular article, it was reported that scientists from the pharmaceutical company Burroughs Wellcome, they were involved in secret illegal vaccine trials for diphtheria on more than 2,000 children in the mother-child homes throughout Ireland. And the story detailed that there was no evidence that consent was ever sought, nor any records of how many babies had died or suffered debilitating side effects as a result. And then another story came out. 10 mother and baby homes carried out vaccine trials on almost 300 children. And this report, or this article, was written by Christina Finn. And she reported that between 1960 and 1976, now it was GlaxoSmithKline, also conducted similar drug trials on children. And the purpose of this trial was to look at the response of the children to this, I think it was a 4-in-1 vaccine that had diphtheria, whooping cough, tetanus, and polio, I believe. And again, the state nor the pharmaceutical company could provide any evidence that consent was ever sought or any records of how many children died or suffered debilitating side effects as a result. And the religious orders who ran the homes involved in the trials also denied involvement and, you know, that they didn't authorize any of the clinical trials. And the mothers of these children also said that they denied consent. But with mounting evidence, you know, accumulating that against government and ecclesiastical systems in Ireland, the old saying is being kept alive in present generations. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And this shouldn't be the case, especially when it comes to people finding their voice, because tremendous courage is needed to heal from intergenerational trauma and embrace the truth and transform into the beautiful soul that you are. And whether or not you know much about your ancestral line, or whether or not you see yourself coming from a long history of people who have been oppressed, or people who were the oppressors, murderers or healers or victims or blue-collar workers or white-collar workers, victims of addictions or completed suicide, victims of divorce, or were there healthy relationships. These all have a physical, emotional, and psychological, spiritual component to discovering the truth. But yes, you see, the truth does set us free. That's just not another catchphrase. It does set us free, but it's a freedom that comes with a tremendous amount of responsibility to continue the soul healing process in the lives of those who have come before us and those who have yet to be born. I encourage you to not only find your voice, but to use your voice. Find others who can support you. Find others who can help you tell your story. Your story is indeed very, very important, not just for your own sake in terms of finding that healing and peace, but also encouraging others and helping others, giving them permission to share their stories and their voice. I'm Dr. James Hauke. It's been my pleasure to be with you here this afternoon. And in the next time that we meet, please be safe, be careful, behave yourselves, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauke, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.